Happy holidays, listeners, and welcome to episode 65 of Making It Women in Film, a podcast where I sit down with women working across the film and TV industry to learn their story and hear all about their craft, career, and vigorous resilience. My name is Vita, and I am so excited to bring this week's episode produced by Bonnie and Bra and Nellis Films to you. Now, as you might hear, I sound a little bit hoarse, a little bit croaky, and that's because I'm ill. So while you will get to listen to our wonderful, amazing, very inspiring, and a bit different interview with playwright Rachel O'Regan, there'll be no roundtable at the end of the episode, but I hope you guys are having an amazing time right now, and that, you know, you're just taking care of yourself. I appreciate you so much for somehow making time to listen to this as well, and I hope that it will inspire you, because it really did to myself. Plays and theater is where all of this came from in the beginning, and so there are many similarities and many things to pull from. I think I'm just gonna let previous Vita, who was not ill, and the incredible Rachel take over from here, and then I'll see you next week, where hopefully I will not be feeling this way and my voice will be much better, and Lauren and I will talk you through our favorite movies of 2022. So happy holidays, happy new year, here's Rachel.
Scotland. Yeah, I write plays, feminist plays usually. I'm a co-director of a women's theatre company in Scotland called F-Bomb Theatre, and we just had our second production at the Fringe this year, which went really well. We're very excited about. And yeah, like in terms of film, I really haven't done that much, but I just finished a sort of development program with BBC Writers Room, which was all about TV drama writing, which I'm really interested in. And yeah, I'm really interested in getting involved in kind of all mediums of writing, and particularly writing for performance. So hopefully I'll be able to.
I mean, theater was the original film, right?
Exactly. You know? I think there's so much transactional skills, mm-hmm. Is that what they call it?
Yes.
which, yeah, can basically be used in film. They are very different, as I found out at the BBC.
Oh yeah.
But there's like core similarities which are really important. And a lot of film screenwriters and TV screenwriters in the UK started out as playwrights, so I'm sort of hoping that happens to me.
You know, it's a journey. I don't think anyone can commit to one thing anymore. There's so much to play with, and I also think the mediums have become so fluid. You really just need to pick the right one for the story, not the other way around. What do you like to write about? What themes do you explore?
I like to write about women. I like to write about women's stories. They don't always have to be like an issue. But they tend to be.
They tend to be some issues, yeah.
Yeah, they tend to be, I mean, I've got a lot of issues. but they tend to be sort of like politically driven, like socially driven, and talking about issues that are relevant for women right now, particularly what's happening right here in the UK and in Scotland. But I like to write women that are flawed and sort of like three-dimensional characters. I like to write about things that I think are important, so like social inequality, and yeah, I've got quite a few things that I need to check off. Like, I really want to write about the environment at one point. I also tend to have a lot of narratives around mental health in my work as well, because I mean, I think that affects everyone, and it just is an important thing to talk about and continue talking about. Yeah, and I also, I mean, it doesn't sound like it because I'm like, these are all the heavy things that I enjoy writing about, but I really like to write comedy, and finding ways of making those topics accessible or palatable, entertaining through the medium of comedy, and particularly comedy that women find funny. Mm-hmm. And I know it's like this sort of stereotype that women aren't funny, mm-hmm. but I think that is, I mean, it's not true, but you know, you only have to watch Bridesmaids to know that that's not true.
Exactly.
But I think we do have different senses of humor sometimes. So I like to write things that like women in particular find really funny,
yeah.
and enjoy performing and enjoy as an audience.
Yeah, yeah. I think especially in the past probably 5-10 years, it's been really interesting to see, in terms of comedy and women, the place that women are also allowed to have in comedy, because I think that's part of the restraint. I think that's part of the stigma and the idea that women aren't funny is the type of comedy that, you know, female comedians get to perform, and what gets put out there as well. It is very limiting. But I love when people like you yourself take topics that are difficult to talk about and then turn them into real life conversations, because that's really how it is, isn't it? Like, the way you joke about it with friends isn't really a way that you can, that's easily displayed on screen, because there's so much room for misunderstanding when you're not talking with your friends, but you're talking to an audience who you've never met. There's a way, like, people want to discuss issues, quote unquote, in media so much now. I don't think there's a single Netflix show that doesn't have issues in them. And I think in a way that's great, but also sometimes it feels so ham-fisted.
Yes. Look, I think it's one of those things that terrifies me and keeps me up at night, especially if I know I've got a production that's going to be out there soon. And I'm like the Beatles were a boy band was my last show, and it was all about male violence and misogyny and like all different things that women go through, but it was also really, really funny. And it was a lot of those conversations that you have with your flatmate on the couch at 3 a.m. like sort of joking about these like traumatic experiences that you've had, but that is real, and that is how people, I guess, process these emotions and process their trauma. And it's also just something that's, I think, is more accessible to an audience rather than coming in and seeing something like super graphic on stage or on screen, which is something that I'm personally think that we have way too much of. But I digress. Your question was, how do I strike that balance? I think it's really important to sort of have it right in the room when you're talking with the actors, when you're talking with the directors. If you think that it's going in a direction that you're like, okay, I think we're maybe, you know, ham-fisting it too much, or like we're making that seem less serious than it actually is, it's okay to like pause and talk through it. But I guess I hope that it comes, like if you're writing from the heart and you're running from a good place, I hope that that comes through in the way that it's perceived. I think when you write comedy where the victim is the butt of the joke, that is always going to come off badly. If you're writing comedy where you're not laughing down at people, but you're sort of laughing at the absurdity of the world and like how all these people have power and do nothing about these terrible things that are happening. If you're doing that kind of comedy, I think you're going to get a lot more people on your side. So yeah, it's tricky. I feel like you can't get it 100% right all the time, but as long as you're mindful and you're constantly checking in with yourself, and you know, I would send my script to people and be like, can you just sense check this and make sure that I'm not being like offensive accidentally? That helps as well.
You can tell when it's written by somebody who has something to say about it and who frequently talks about it, and when it's like, oh, we should talk about this, you know, we should include this, and then suddenly a real life character starts talking like an article.
I think like it's really important to be educated, as much as like I'm like, if it comes from a good place, like it can't be taken badly. Well, it can if you're like not educated. Your heart can be in the right place, but if you're writing about something you really don't know about, or you shouldn't be writing about, that's not your experience, not your story to tell, then that's also another story. So I tend to write things after I've done a lot of research as well.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember what the first thing that you wrote was? The first story?
Like professionally?
No, not professionally. I'm talking about like the flying dog, you know?
I wrote a poem about a tree when I was in high school. It was like a poem about like an old man, but then you realized it was a tree by the end. And then he died.
Oh, no. did the tree get chopped, or what was it?
I think so, yeah. I don't quite remember, but he was definitely dead by the end. I thought it was very deep, and my dad really liked that poem. Like, he framed it and everything. He was like, this is so great. I don't even remember when I wrote that. That can't have been the first story I ever wrote, because I've been writing forever, but it's definitely the first one I can remember.
That's really funny. That's because one of the first stories I remember writing was about a Christmas tree that was turned into a broom, and the broom was used all the time, but then suddenly the broom was in the closet and the vacuumer was like taking over. So that, yeah, something about trees and dying and being cast aside themes.
Yeah, yeah. Just like normal stuff you write when you're 14.
Five, yeah.
Absolutely.
When you were growing up, what kind of, like, do you feel like you had a creative environment around you? Was it normal for you to be so into writing, or was it something that kind of stuck out?
I just was always really into books. Like, as a little kid, I was really into reading. And, like, to be honest, like, creative stuff is my only skill. Like, I think you tend to do things that you're good at. And I was good at writing. I was good at creative stuff. Like, my parents they fostered that for sure. My mum was really into, like, drawing and painting. And, you know, I've never wanted for books to read in my house. So I think also we didn't have a TV for the longest time. And I think that helped in sort of a strange way, because then you didn't really have anything else to do but read.
That's true.
So I think that helped to make me better reader, writer. And then we got a TV, and it was like,
oh, I'm game over. Watching
movies for hours. and that was over.
what was your book?
Oh gosh. I really like the Jacqueline Wilson books, because they were so highly traumatizing.
Oh, no.
I don't know if you know them.
I'm familiar, not through First Encounter though. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how these books ever made it into the real world, but they're like written for children, or I guess like sort of tween young adults, and they just deal with the most gritty, like hardcore subject matters. Like Tracy Beaker is based off a Jacqueline Wilson book, which is about a child in a care home. So just like, it's just stories about kids, but like the worst stuff happens to them.
That's for sure an introduction.
I really liked those. I mean, I really liked Harry Potter.
I know, me too.
Yeah,
I say through my teeth. It's complicated. Yes.
It's complicated, isn't it?
It's complicated.
But I feel like I've moved past that now.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But just anything that was either had like a fantastical element to it, or was just like really too real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get that. when do you think you realized that this was what you wanted to pursue?
I think I was always really good at English in school, so I sort of thought, well, I should do stuff with writing. And I actually did journalism as my degree first. My first degree was in media and journalism, because I sort of thought, well, I want to be a writer, but what are the odds of that happening? I should get like a real job, as it were, a real degree. And I just didn't see like what opportunities were out there. And I think being, I lived in Australia, there was not really as much going on there, at least at the time. So I went into journalism, and look, it was fine. And I still do media. I still do like content creation for different brands and stuff. But I just felt like creatively, I had more to say than just like representing another company or another brand.
Yeah.
There was a company called the Australian Theatre for Young People who had sort of like a week-long retreat where you go out into the countryside and write a monologue with, you know, the leading playwrights of Australia. And I got in, and then they selected my piece to go into their showcase that was happening in front of a live audience. And that was the first time that I've ever had my work performed. And I got addicted. I loved having my work performed, because I think there's something so incredible in being able to produce something, but then giving it to someone else, and then they get to, you know, do something different with it. They direct it, they act it. It's their interpretation. And then it's different every night if you're in theatre.
Yeah.
Love the liveness of that art form. So after that, I just did everything I could to sort of be a playwright.
And that was Red Bull, right?
Yes. Yes. You've studied my CV well.
I have. Yes, yes, yes. So with seeing your work performed, do you ever feel protective of your work? Because obviously you have to kind of have the trust to hand it over as well.
Yeah, you do. I feel like the people that I work with, I usually have a really high level of trust in them. They're all really talented, and I know they're going to do something amazing with it. I know that every writer have their own process, and some playwrights are very particular about their words and having them be exact, and you know, they want them to be exactly this, and they want to be very prescriptive, and I think to an extent, you know, that you have a right to sort of exercise your artistic ownership of that. But I also think that theatre is a collaborative art form, so you have to be able to collaborate. And with F-bomb, like, I will come into rehearsals, and if they're like, this line's not working, like, could we try this, or they just have like an amazing idea in the room, I'm really open and receptive to that, and it makes the work better in the end, because I don't think there's just like one person with good ideas, you know. So yeah, I think if you're not willing to sort of hand over your work to someone else, and let them interpret it, then perhaps theatre might not be for you, or you might not have a great time in it, at least.
So tell me more about F-bomb. When did that begin? What was the root of that?
F-bomb actually started as a student company. So it was a bunch of acting students who got together and formed the company. And it was really in response to sort of a lack of good, complex female roles that were given to do as students in their undergrad. And they were going to do a show at the Fringe, and they were struggling again to find a play that was going to suit all of them, being women, Scottish, and, you know, young women, something that had roles for all of them, that were all complex, and they weren't just like side characters that were there just to stand there and look pretty, you know. So that's when they got in touch with me and I joined the company. So we started with my play After Party, which was at the Fringe 2021, which was all about sort of social mobility and, you know, class conflict. It was also comedy. And it centered around sort of a group of teenage girls who live in a sort of a rundown area, and they're grappling with their future as they're finishing school. And it went really well for us. Like, we sold out our entire run, which is kind of unheard of, especially for like a first company or a student company.
That's amazing.
We had lots of women, lots of particularly young women coming in to see our work. And, you know, the fact is, like, they did a survey and nearly 2/3 of the theatre audiences in the UK are women. But in terms of, like, are they getting work made for them that is, like, marketed to them, programmed for them to come see it? I would argue not enough. So they loved it, and we grew a really strong sort of community and following out of that. And off the back of After Party, we were able to come to do The Beatles Were a Boy Band at this year's Fringe, and that went really well for us as well.
Yes, I mean, it did.
Yeah, it's kind of, I still have to pinch myself of how that went, because we won a Fringe Fest. Like, bucket list ticked. Wasn't even on my bucket list, because I was like, as if you can, you know, put that on your bucket list, be serious.
I mean, how did that, just like, before you won, how were you feeling about the play, and kind of what was the atmosphere like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole play, like, the run was only a week long, so it was just like an emotional week. It was the first time that that play had ever been performed, like, all the way through. And also, it was the first time it'd ever been in front of an audience. You just never know how anyone's going to react, especially when you're dealing with such a difficult subject matter in such a unique way. So I was nervous. Like, I think I was so nervous that I actually felt calm, because I was just, like, I'd phase everything out. And... yeah, someone from The Scotsman came to review it. And, you know, I think they're quite hard to get a good review from sometimes. So if you get a good review from them, it's kind of like a stamp of approval. And we got 4 stars from them. And that was the best news ever. Like, I was like, it can't get better than this. But The Scotsman, they run the Fringe Fest Awards. So they emailed us and said, like, can we have a comp ticket for the performance tonight, so that we can, you know, take it as consideration for the Fringe Fest. And I was like, yeah, of course, like, you could come, like, bring anyone, like, literally, like, we'll roll out the red carpet for you. But they were like, oh, we can't stay too long though, so, like, you know, if you're not running on time, we may have to leave. And the Fringe, like, it rarely runs on time. So manic. And the people before us, the people 2 shows before us, I should specify, were always running over, always. So we ended up, like, going on 20 minutes late, and I was like, this Fringe Fest guy, he's gonna have left. He's not, even if he comes in, he's gonna hate us because we made him wait for 20 minutes in the stairwell. But then, so I just kind of forgot about it. And then the next morning, they called me up and they were like, we want to give you the Fringe Fest. And I literally, like, almost fell over. So that's the timeline. It was a very good week.
I mean, I guess, like, before you won, what was your favorite part about this year's Fringe?
It was a full-scale Fringe again. I mean, when we went with After Party, it was sort of, we were still kind of coming out of lockdown, and there were a lot of, you know, COVID procedures in place, and we didn't know until really soon before the Fringe if we were even going to be able to do it. So it was nice not to have to think about that. So yeah, it was good. Like the audiences were big, and I think like the streets were, you know, there was people everywhere, and you could really feel like the excitement of the Fringe. I think for me though, one of my favorite things was the community that came out of it. So we had sort of, let me tell this story.
Okay.
This person on Twitter had been posting every day almost, and replying to all these tweets that were, you know, tagging the Fringe or talking about the Fringe, saying that there was too much women's work or too much feminist work at the Fringe, something like that. And you know, they had a mission. They were out to tell everyone about it. And it almost became like a running joke, because we would see that username like pop up every time someone tweeted about the Fringe, and they'd be like, there's just too many women. And they would always use the hashtag FemiFringe, I guess kind of to be like, it's a feminist fringe now. The Fringe is becoming the FemiFringe. And
God, what an insult. How horrible.
I know. And like, I saw quite a few people like kind of take notice of this guy, or like get annoyed by him and his tweetings. And then one day I just like was like, you know what, I'm gonna make something good out of this situation. And I used his hashtag FemiFringe, and I sort of tagged one sort of women-led or feminist-led piece of work that was happening for every day of the Fringe. And I was like, yes, it's a Femi Fringe, and isn't that great? And sort of like this amazing community had built around this hashtag, and people were sharing their work, and it meant that like women who were interested in that kind of work knew what was going on and knew where it was happening. And then we built a program as well, which you could like download off the F1 Theatre website, just so you knew like, these are all the works that are made by women. These are the works made by, you know, non-binary people and feminist-led theatre. Go see them, go support them. So that was really great for me, just to see that community come out of it. Yeah, I mean, the Fringe is competitive, but if we don't work together, it's like, we can always be stronger together.
Exactly. On that note, what was your favourite things that you saw this Fringe? I know you had a busy week yourself, of course.
I saw Land, which was, I forget who wrote it, forgive me, but it was starring Bethany Tennick, and that was brilliant. I think that was my favorite thing that I saw at the Fringe. It was in a tiny, tiny theater room, like super small, kind of like you could hear like the other theaters work sort of happening all around you, but in this intimate space. It was just a beautiful story about like Scottish land, and it was really well done, and I hope it comes back next year.
Obviously we'll get into your journey into screenwriting, but from theater, what is your favorite thing about theater? What is it that really, really speaks to you more than anything?
I think, as I said before, it's the liveness of it. I think like every single performance is different. A lot of writers don't like watching their own work, and like sometimes I also will find it cringe, or like it's, you know, painful, but I also really enjoy going to see my own work sometimes because I get to see what the actors are doing. That is incredible. And I get to see like the choices that the director's made, and the audience's reactions as well. And it's just so rewarding. I love theatre. I think there's something that's really impactful about being in a space and having something live acted out in front of you, and it makes you feel like you're in it. It also is one of those mediums where, like, you can't be on your phone. I don't know about you, but, like, I'll have, like, five devices in front of me if I'm, like, watching something on TV or I'm watching a movie. And that's fine. Like, that's how I get things done. But when you're in a theater, like, you can't be on your phone. So I like that it's, like, you know, an hour or two where you just, like, you sit and you're just completely absorbed in this story and these characters. So, yeah.
And screenwriting, film, television. I mean, I know you mentioned that you didn't have a television for a while growing up. What's kind of been your journey, your relationship with filmmaking, with screenwriting? Has there been a moment where you started to realize, oh, this is something I kind of want to, you know, test the waters of?
Yeah, I mean, I've always really wanted to write for TV specifically. I just love TV.
Favorite? I mean, no, you can't say that with TV. I feel like I can't ask for one favorite TV show, but
yeah,
it's that one.
Oh my gosh, you're literally gonna crucify me.
No.
My comfort show is Grey's Anatomy.
I can't blame you.
It's my comfort.
Sure, maybe her other work recently hasn't been that amazing, but I love Shonda Rhimes.
God, yeah.
She is a game changer, and I will watch Grey's Anatomy. I will. No shame. Yeah.
It's not like, you know, it's not the best TV ever made.
But it's far from the worst. It is far from the worst.
And I also think, like, it was ahead of its time in a lot of ways. It always sort of had its finger on the social issues. And I mean, I grew up in Australia where diversity is just like rarely a thing. And Grey's Anatomy comes, you know, on TV when I'm a teenager. And, you know, you've got Sandra Oh, you have Shonda Wilson, you have like all these amazing actors of color. And the show is like made by an amazing black woman. So, you know, I have a lot of love in my heart for Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah. And a lot of respect also, not just for the diversity, but the roles, the representation that was given as well, not just, you know, a tick of a box, but actually thoroughly included and thought out, you know, representation, which still today you struggle to see. So definitely, you know, people go back to the early seasons. You'll be surprised.
Yes.
Yeah. And the fact that it's also been able to go on for so long, being as kind of radical in a way for television at the time is very impressive. So I think that does say something. But back to television. What was the moment that you were like, oh, maybe I should write a screenplay?
Well, to be honest, I've not written one yet. I've done like treatments and all that kind of other stuff. I think with TV, there is a process to getting stuff made, which I fully didn't understand until I got into BBC Writers' Room. So like with theatre, it's like you write a script and then you send it to someone, or like you produce it and then they make it and it's produced and yay. With TV, it's different. I think a lot of times you get commissioned off like a treatment and then you work on it with the whole team and they want to be part of that process. And then you can also write things like spec scripts, but it's very unlikely that you'll be commissioned off the back of that. So it's just a lot of work to put into like a full screenplay that is, you know, potentially never going to see the light of day. So I just haven't been able to manage it just yet, writing a full screenplay, but I definitely want to. I think I've always really wanted to. It's just that theatre, I think playwriting is maybe a little bit less technical than TV. And I'm still sort of learning those rules, and I was able to sort of step into playwriting a little bit easier than sort of the screen aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. No, it's, you know, as you said, even theatre is very layered, loads of, I mean, hundreds of different people working on it, but then television, you've got thousands, you know. It's a big and time-consuming thing to get into. What's kind of, as you, you know, going into the BBC's writers' room, which is also exciting, congratulations, that's like an accomplishment. What were some of the immediate and kind of surprising differences between playwriting and screenwriting that you were faced with?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is one of them. The fact, like, the way that things are commissioned is so different. And just the way that the business is run is so different. There's lots more money in TV, which is really exciting, but it also means that you have more stakeholders. So you may not have as much control over your story than you would in theatre. I think, you know, you can have conversations with directors in theatre, producers, like actors even, like, yeah, I don't know about this, or like, maybe we switch that. Whereas if you're working in TV, a lot of the time, like, at least from what I've heard and what people who are friends in the TV industry have told me, is that you can end up spending a lot of time fighting for your own work and fighting to be heard as the writer. So I definitely am interested in a TV career. It's just like that is one thing that I probably wasn't expecting.
What about the medium kind of speaks to you over film, say?
I mean, I have no like big reason why I'm more interested in TV than film. I think I just watch more TV. But I think as a writer, I'm really interested in like how those narratives and characters build over, you know, 10 hours versus 2 hours. And there's just so much space for like nuance and development. And I'm really interested in that. I think for me, like compared to theatre, like TV has such a potential for reach. You can reach so many people with it. So if you're putting in content which is potentially gonna help explain an issue or, you know, speak to someone, then you have like hundreds of thousands of people who could potentially, millions of people who could be watching it, versus theatre, which is on a much smaller scale. So that definitely appeals to me. I think recently, actually, Sex Education did an episode where they dealt with, I think it was HIV, and they just put in some really good, like, informative facts about it. And I know we spoke before about things not, we don't want things to be textbooky, but it was going to, like, literally, like, help change people's lives. I think that's a really exciting opportunity to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny because I think, you know, one of the pros about theater is that it's limited to one room, but then the pro about television is that it is not, and you know, can reach thousands if not millions of rooms, which is also a scary thought. I think, you know, your audience is so much wider, the, you know, criticism, the praise is so, like, there's so much more of it. How do you, in general, because obviously now with The Fringe as well, you know, you've gotten publicity. How have you learned to deal with it, and kind of, has it been a learning curve? Obviously, you've gotten a lot of praise, but I'm sure as that guy on Twitter, like, there's also people who aren't so positive. What's your experience been with publicity and kind of art criticism?
Yeah, I mean, I've got my fair share of bad reviews. I think, like, you're always going to get them. I also think, though, that if you're getting, like, really good reviews and bad reviews, like, you're doing something right.
Because, yes, completely.
You want to make art that challenges people and, you know, people have different opinions on, rather than something that is, like, sort of more middle of the road, at least for me. So, yeah, I don't know. It is hard. Sometimes your confidence can really take a hit. And I feel like sometimes I'm like Taylor Swift because I just like hold on to these things and never let them go or like turn them into my next piece of art. Like the Beatles were a boy band. Like the whole title of that play is based on when a critic was sort of, it was a number of critics actually, who kept mentioning the amount of teen angst in my show After Party. And I was like, well, you know, these characters are dealing with poverty and, you know, teenage pregnancy and their lives are not easy. Why is that boiled down to teen angst? And why do we always just sort of invalidate teenage girls? And then I saw,
why do we hate fangirls? It is a very interesting.
Absolutely. And like the teenage fans of the Beatles, I mean, they were girls and they were hated at the time. And now they're sort of revered as like the number one band of all time. But, you know, do the teenage girl fans who supported them at first ever get credit? I don't think so. So, yeah, I mean, I guess my advice is like, take, like, I think that criticisms can be valid, but when it's like you think that it's bullshit, then take that and put it into something. And
yeah, fair point. All the more reason to talk with your peers and get everybody's opinion face to face, not in an email that you have to, you know, get yourself to open. A bit more about film recommendations. TV, we can do TV, but I want to hear a bit about what inspires you.
Yeah, so I was like a hardcore geek like back in the day. I loved Doctor Who and I loved Torchwood. But I think like I'd never really engaged with sci-fi before. And I think if you're talking about like a medium that has limitless possibilities, that's the one. So I really enjoyed those. And I think the first thing I ever watched where I was like, wow, that is like excellent TV, was actually Torchwood miniseries Children of Earth. And I don't know if anyone listening to this has watched it, but it was like a 5-episode arc where these aliens come and they want the children of Earth basically. And they're like, it sounds so silly, but there are so many like really gripping moral conversations that are happening in this miniseries. And I think I was like, how can a show that has like a pterodactyl and like a time traveling immortal also have these incredible, like almost theatrical moments in it? So I think that was, I mean, I was a teenager when that came out, and obviously anything you watch when you're, you know, 15 is gonna impact you a lot. But it is very good, and I still highly recommend that miniseries.
I'll take the recommendation. Yeah. I'll check it out. And more recently, what have you been watching? Is there anything specifically that stuck out to you?
Not TV wise. I can give some film recommendations.
Go for it.
I recently watched Not Okay, which was on Disney Plus, and I thought that was amazing. It is a story about a girl who fakes being in a terror attack in Paris. And it's just like, it's the funniest movie, but done with so much style, and it has like, it just is so spot on in its social observations. I don't know if it was that successful. I don't know if many people have watched it, but I thought it was incredible. And I just watched The Wonder, which is now on Netflix. Obviously, Florence Pugh is incredible. Chef's kiss. But I read the book before, like ages, years ago, and I really enjoyed it. And this is one of those movies where it's really, really faithful to the book, I felt, but also has its own identity, and I just felt it was really good. So those are two recommendations, completely at the opposite end of the spectrum.
I mean, we like the range. I think that's really important. You can't just be stuck in one end or another. That's the beauty of it all, is when those stories can transcend all kinds of genres. What about a movie or a show that you would love, like, what's a movie or a show that you'd love to experience for the first time again?
I feel like all the thoughts just like fell out of my
I get it. I
head.
get it. I think it's also that way, when you're kind of in the creative space and people ask for recommendations and I'm like, huh? Everything I've ever watched just, disappears from me and I don't know what to say. So that's fine. I think watching movies again is such an in like interesting concept because to some people it's a movie that they watched at a time where they weren't ready to watch it and didn't have the capability to see it, and for others it's movies with twists they wish you could watch again and experience the shock. For me, I think the movie I would watch for the first time again is actually my favorite movie, which I've only seen once because I can't imagine watching it in any other way than I did the first time, which is Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I watched that in the cinema, and it was like the most physical experience I think I've ever had in cinema. Like I was sobbing in there, and you could just feel it vibrating so much, like in the entire room. And I don't want to watch it again. Like it is sincerely my favorite movie. I've read the script a couple of times, but I can't get myself to put it on the telly. Like it's on Netflix now, but I can't get myself to press play because I just know it wouldn't be the same, and I don't want to do the disservice to it of watching it in that way.
Yeah. So I think a movie that if I could watch again for the very first time, probably one with like a really good twist. So like Parasite,
Oh,
that
yes.
movie like changed something in my brain. I could not believe what I was seeing. Or like Promising Young Woman. I don't know if I could put myself rewatching that again. But the ending is so unexpected that I love things like that where they sort of pull the rug out from under you,
Yeah.
but not for any sort of like just for the sake of it way, like it
Yeah.
was done with purpose. So I really love stuff like that where, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've got some good recommendations in here. I like the span of it all. 14-year-old Rachel. 14-year-old Rachel who wrote a poem about a man who became a tree and then died. How do you think she would react if she could see you now?
She'd probably be like, "Why aren't you married? What's going on?" Like, I don't know if she would be that happy. Sorry, that was a bit too unfiltered.
It's that's really funny.
I don't know. Like, I feel like your dreams when you're 14 are just like a lot of times they're not realistic and they don't like you don't really know what is out there when you're 14. And but if you asked me like my 5 years ago, Rachel, she would be ecstatic.
That's amazing.
It.
Yeah, that's good. That's good, I like the idea of like living up to the person you used to be and kind of what they wanted to do. But then again, I'm like 12-year-old me would be terrified. Like I was
Yeah, I mean,
not made out for this when I
I'm
was
all
12,
for being like, young people are like they're valid and they have, really important perspectives. But when I was that age, I was stupid. So.
When I was that age, I was fucking annoying. I was so obnoxious.
Yeah. I didn't know anything about the world and I'm. Don't know that much now, but I'm getting there.
Well, I'm glad that you 5 years ago is proud of where you are now. I think it's important to remember and kind of put that stuff into perspective. We've been talking a lot about, supporting other creatives and highlighting, each other and not fighting, because there's not a lot of space, and I think we can only do better if we, you know, actually give each other a hand. On that note, is there a woman in the film and TV industry right now that is a source of inspiration to you that you'd like to give a shout out to?
Lisa McGee, who wrote Derry Girls, is incredible. And like, I wish I could be that funny for like 5 minutes of my life. I wish I had her comedic talent. I think it's incredible how far Derry Girls has gone. Like, it is loved everywhere in the world. And, you know, it is such a specific story for, you know, teenagers living through the troubles in the 90s and in Derry in Northern Scotland. Sorry, not Scotland. In Northern Ireland. However, like, the things that they go through are also so universal, and the comedy is so universal, and it is just like one of the best shows, I think, in the last 10 years. Like, it's got to be up there with either my favorite or one of my favorite shows.
And for everyone listening who wants to, you know, see what's happening in Rachel's life, see what you're doing and creating, where should they go? Where do you want to send them?
Well, you can follow me on social media. I'm like Rach Writes Plays on Twitter and Instagram. And then you can follow F-Bomb Theatre as well, because hopefully we'll have some exciting things to announce in the near future. And we're just F-Bomb Theatre on all social media. So, yeah.
It's been really, really nice talking with you, Rachel, and hearing everything you had to say, and kind of, you know, bringing the origins of theatre, the origins of film itself, I think, into the conversation. I'll let you have the last word. And if you have anything you want to say to whoever's listening out there who is maybe on the same path as you, who's in one field of writing and want to get into the screen sector, or who just loves to tell stories.
I think it's really important to, when you're writing, to remember that our industry skews very white, cis, male, you know, middle class, able-bodied. And those things do impact, you know, the work that is going on in our industry. And it can impact how you see your own work and how you see yourself. When I was writing my last play, The Beatles Were a Boy Band, I kept coming up to these parts where I was writing the script and would think about what the critics would say, or what, you know, XYZ would say, you know, would they like this bit? And if I ever got to a point where I was like, should I cut this because it's too, you know, feminine, or it's too out there, or it's too much like, you know, not for them and kind of for me, then I kept it. So I think just believe in your own voice and don't ever like water yourself down for anyone. And yeah, I think you'll find your people and you'll find your audience when you do that. So that would be my advice if I were to give any.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Making It Women in Film, a podcast produced by Bonnie and Brawl and LS Films. If you want to support this podcast, you can do so by subscribing to us wherever you're listening and leave a review or a rating. It'll only take you a few clicks, but it'll mean the world to us. You can also check out our website, womeninfilm.co.uk, follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram at makingwomeninfilm, and feel free to shoot us an email at makingwomeninfilm@gmail.com if you have any questions or inquiries or anything at all, and we'll try to get back to you. Alright, guess I'll just see you next week. Bye!